Oh, it's warm.
I know, hot bums.
He's got a very hot bottom, hasn't he? It's almost on fire.
Actually, you know what? I think I should. I think if we could both stand up for a minute to cool off. These sofas are.
They really are heating up.
Yeah, they are.
My posterior is on fire. Absolutely on fire. Yes.
Okay.
Do we start straight
away?
Shall I introduce myself to you, Lisa?
Yeah, tell me.
Can I call you Lisa?
Absolutely.
I like all the casualness. I was a bit anxious downstairs.
No. The casualness is because...
That's
right,
very good.
This is my first interaction with you as somebody who is... I've Googled you so thoroughly.
God.
is because as part of something that I did mention, which was, as it were, the unacknowledged differences between... men and those of women,
right.
Not of women, or women and men in general. I am too short to sit like you're sitting. Look.
Right.
I can't sit like that.
I'm 6 foot.
Right.
But you bend into that perfectly.
So you meld
into it really well.
So long experience has taught me that you have to put your feet up. And I can tell you that this is not just a casual generalization, but a generalization based on two examples, which is about the maximum that I can do.
About the what?
The maximum. Because generalizations, I went to buy a chair today at Habitat, as you do, a reclining chair. And I'd actually gone to buy it last week, and I sat in the chair, and I thought it was completely fantastic. And it had a footstool, and I lay there for some time to the amusement of the young man who was trying to serve me. And then I went home and I said to my husband, would you go and test the chair? I think it's the most fantastic chair. We really need a comfortable chair, please. And he came back and said, it's rubbish.
Right.
Was it
the one that does that kind of fisting up your back?
No.
That you can get at airports?
He said it's too short for me. The footstool is too low.
Right.
And I was so uncomfortable. And I said, hold on a minute. This chair is for me to sit in. I really don't care if it's uncomfortable for you. But it did seem to be quite interesting that on that little, you know, that this is not trivial. This is
no,
very
this
important.
Is just the kind
it's
of
important.
Intermission
it's a fact
conversation.
Of life. It's a fact of life. And it's part of the whole way in which we very curiously, each of us, creates the world around us.
Right.
One by one. Right. So he wasn't being mean. He was just seriously saying, this is a very uncomfortable chair. And I said, it's a very comfortable chair. Now, in a way, the sorts of rather huge things that people were talking about before I came along and lowered the tone, is the huge things they're talking about depend on believing we're all the same. And depend on believing that there are these things called the Northern Rock Investors, which we got, you know, the Northern Rock Investors ran from, you know, little old ladies with all their life savings to big speculators, and they were some of them men and some of them women, and they're completely different, and we've got to figure out how to involve them all in the world in which we live, and you do that for a living.
Apparently, but I think I have to introduce myself. I
was okay, called out, yes.
And they get very aggressive at the back.
They say,
I have to say, hello, my name's Andrew Cotting.
Oh, I didn't do that.
No, I have
well,
to do it. Apparently,
Andrew
I have
Cotting
to. It's in my
anyway,
contract. So. They said, I don't get the bolt.
Your name is Andrew Cotting. Okay.
My name's Andrew Cotting. I'm an artist and filmmaker, is what they told me to
say.
And this is the bit I'm going to improvise here. I'm a bowler, and also, I think everything's brilliant.
Yeah.
I'm an optimist.
It's
all brilliant.
God
everything's brilliant.
The front row will be particularly pleased that you are an optimist.
And earlier on, I wasn't wearing really shoes, worried. But I put them on because I thought, Lisa Jardine, she's probably wearing a nice frock, Winsiette, proper shoes.
Yes.
And I came in, I was so relieved. You were there. Like this,
is that a real tattoo?
Yeah, I used to get bored in the French lessons.
Oh.
And the idea was to go all the way up the leg.
But you never got
there. Yeah, I got 28. I thought, I've got to stop doing this. I didn't go to French.
All
so,
right.
Yeah, when I saw you like this with Stephen, I thought this is going to be a lot more informal than I imagined.
Well, it is. Were you worried?
A little bit. I think because I'm playing as well.
Yeah. Okay.
And my head was really into the playing today. And that's been so exhilarating, so exciting. Have you been up?
I have been up. Has everybody been up?
Right, and it is.
So you were playing.
Yeah, I'm a bowler. So I'm doing the bowling and the stroking and a little bit of thrusting as well.
Could we just not go there?
Yes. Right. Well, they're very phallic. I do think these
are there
these
any girls bowling?
Lots of, and in fact, Hayley, she might be in the audience. There's a girl
thank
there.
God. They huff on it as well. Whether she's thrust, was she thrusting too?
Were you thrusting? No, she wasn't thrusting. Yeah. But it has been, I wanted to talk about that a little bit because it's been so exciting.
All right. But so now tell me how in your professional life you make people of all different...
sizes?
Complexions. In the broadest sense.
Yes. How do I double them?
Yes.
I normally go, hello, my name's Andrew, and I'm an optimist. Right, and everything's going to be brilliant.
All right.
I don't know. It's so, you do it because you have. It's about communication skills.
Yes, it is.
And multitasking. You know, earlier on when you were talking about this, I always had this idea of kind of spinning plates, and you know, some of them are going to break. And I think as you move through life, you just accept that. And as a kind of jack of all trades, master of none, which is something that I think Stuart Brisley taught me that when I was at the Slate. You kind of just think, well, you're going to have to make it up as you go along. And some things you will hone, some skills you will develop, some things you will get better at. But if you become too precious, if you concentrate too much on three or four of those plates spinning on the sticks, then you become too anal and you lose your way a little bit.
But are you, when you're spinning your plate, I mean, I think life is like that. I think that is exactly what you're doing. But is that part of a project to change the world? Because I'm not just an optimist, I want to change the world. I actually do think we owe it to everybody to get ourselves out. I don't think we are in a worse mess than my grandparents' generation. I mean, my grandparents came from a shtetl in Poland, and my parents grew up in abject poverty. And you know, it was a big mess for them then. And we mostly get very middle-class people telling us they're in a terrible mess because their pension fund's gone down.
And my grandmother, she only had four pairs of pence. And she was from, you know... A kind of
four could be my mother only had
picking.
Two.
Well, she only had four pairs of pants, and I remember as a kid thinking, "Geez, actually, I can't afford them, Andrew. I've got no money whatsoever." And it's true, but she was an optimist. She looked on the bright side of things.
Right, so I stopped myself from saying, you know, the mess we're in, because I don't think we are in a particularly, you know, the mess. And I think that humanity has faced a lot of messes in its time. And the reason the human race still is on the planet is their extraordinary adaptability, right? Capacity to adapt.
Resilience.
And that resilience. And that has a lot to do with optimism, because actually, if you are a total pessimist, you just crawl up and die, don't you? I mean, you do. Can you, because I don't know you.
I don't know you either.
No, because we don't know each other, right?
Yes.
Could you...
Can I sit on your lap?
I'd rather sit on yours.
It is a bit bigger, isn't it?
Yeah, that's right. I think we might have that boy-girl problem if you
It's going to be a boy-girl
right?
problem. And I can't do blueberries either. I'm au fait with Final Cut and things digital.
Okay. All right,
but
very
I can't
good.
Do...
Final Cut, I like that.
Can't afford one. Not at the moment. But iPhones,
Should
I think...
Should come
round
and borrow ours? Would you like to? It's really cool.
I'll get me on. After this,
we've got
I'm
very
get
technical
me on.
Here. Yes. Right. Yes. Tell me... So. If the project of the conversation that I've got into over the last three people, three or four, is about
optimism, hope,
whether hope,
hope's
Steve,
a good
word, but whether there are philosophies and strategies for being part of a future which holds out promise for the human race, right? I mean, that's not the same.
No, at all. And I think in a way you were talking earlier about being global, I kind of like the idea of the cottage. And the cottage is still, you know, provided it's... you're starting small, but you're going out. You inseminate. It's like a little virus that you can send out there. And just recently, I'm very familiar with Bobby Baker's work. And I was reading a book this summer whilst I was away. And I don't know if you know Bobby Baker's work.
Very
but,
well.
You know, it's an amazing woman. But there's something about the scale at which she works, which, you know, first glance, you'd think it was small. You'd think it was quite...
Brilliant.
But she touches the lives of so many other people, but with the really simplistic little things that she does. And I think, in a way, my kind of bigger project, and maybe this is since, you know, my daughter came into my life 21 years ago, Eden, you know, who's severely disabled. She has a very rare genetic condition, you know, Joubert syndrome. It kind of makes you really... I had great ideas when I was an art student that I wanted to conquer the world. I wanted to kind of produce work, merchandise, and so on. And then suddenly things stop, and you think, well, hang on a minute. You know, I actually have something infinitely more important to do with my life now. which is, you know, try and bring this this child up. And it kind of makes you pull onto the hard shoulder. It makes you reappraise so many things. And yet, at the same time, she became, or is, a microcosm for the world at large.
Yeah.
And it's kind of about humility. The one thing that she taught me was humility. And at a very early age, you realise that your ego actually is not as important as you used to think it was. And that ego, I think, is the virus, the negative virus, that especially with men, quite often the world over, that becomes the big problem. You're going home in the fucking ambulance,
yes.
That kind of thing. And you get a lot of that.
No, but I think you're really right about that.
Mm.
I think that a lot of people, but I think all my sisters, I have quite a few of them, have gone through their life to roughly my age, I mean,
right.
Within a few years of it, without having had any kind of life-changing experience of that kind. And they sort of, the trajectory of their life looks very simple. At the same time, it looks very aimless, because in a sense, they've just kept doing what they did after they left school and some more of it and got married and whatever.
Mm.
But you have a disabled child and I had a very grave illness. And
yeah,
both of
yeah,
those
I picked up on that.
Turn you, they just stop you.
Mm.
And you think about being human. This is not in the slightest sentimental, because I'm not. It's a very extraordinary thing to actually have that opportunity to
absolutely.
Consider your own humanity.
It's a seismic shift.
And that's what makes me a responsible optimist, because your humanity is everyone else's humanity. Mm. I'm not a believer in any religion, but I do believe in common humanity.
Absolutely.
That inside people is this connector, like Lego bricks. You know, we like Lego bricks, that we have the connecting bits that connect.
We couldn't afford Lego. No, we didn't.
Tinker toy, they're like
no,
the connectors
plastic
in Tinker
cups
toy.
And bits of chewing gum off the pavements.
Oh,
that's
no,
what we have
yes.
when we grew up.
Okay.
But no, I'm there with the Lego.
You're there with
yes,
the Lego?
There with the Lego, yes,
okay.
Absolutely.
So that, and that... That contemplation of your own humanity. I'm sorry. That contemplation. No, it isn't contemplative. That scrutiny of your own inner self when you find your body or somebody else close to you's body has just at odds with the whole of the. With all the things that it was expected to do, or it's let you down, or, you know. So then you discover that there is this thing which is much bigger than that.
Yeah.
And which you share. You definitely share it with other people. One of the things that I discovered when I was ill was just how extraordinarily people connect with you, people you've never known. Mm-hmm. You could be walking down the street and people will say to you, are you all right?
Yeah, it's a brilliant level. It's the same thing about, you know, with Eden's disability. You suddenly, you're privileged in a way to enter into a world that you read about and you might see a little bit, but then to be immersed in it is such a privilege.
So we must be able to harness that.
Yeah, absolutely. And even today, you know, with Jem, you know, the long player.
Yeah.
It starts off as an idea and it's become kind of becomes a reality and it becomes reality again. And it's thing that, you know, what arrogance, what ego to believe that something that you could, you know, kick into play. In 1999, December the 31st, is still running.
Yeah.
And I suspect will still be running in 1,000 years' time. And people that have kind of been infected by it today, that might have been upstairs, that have experienced it, and experienced it on all kind of different levels, you know, but to have been in that place and to have tapped into it, all because of one man's ego, is just a remarkable thing.
Well,
and yet he's not an ego.
Well,
he's
I was
not
gonna
this
say that.
Amazingly
vain.
He's not. He's a Bobby Baker. He had a small idea, which just happens to be remarkable.
Bobby Baker is a performance artist who started. Backstory.
She makes cakes.
She started her work in her own kitchen, and the audience came into her own kitchen and watched her performing a very fragmented and disturbed relationship between a woman and domesticity, and it got bigger, and the idea got bigger, and the whole thing. But
and she came from Sidcup.
And she came from Sidcup.
Which is where my grandmother came from, who only had four pairs of pants.
My grandmother came from Filey Avenue.
Yes, where's Filey Avenue?
It's up in Stamford Hill.
All right. North London. We never went north.
70s route, bus route.
Right, no, we were Deptford.
Yeah, right.
It's true.
Okay, so but I was just going to pick up on that. I don't think it's one man's ego, if you don't mind my saying. It's one man's dream or one man's. It's that conviction
Absolutely,
that you can make something happen. And I think the saddest thing, which I had totally confirmed today, but it's just so sad, the saddest thing about people with this enormous brain power to do things like neuroscience and high economic theory and whatever, is the kind of ruthlessness which they undercut it all by saying, and it's completely hopeless. Mm. You know, it's unbelievably difficult, much too hard for you to understand. Mm. Only we, very few mandarins, understand it. And by the way, it produces insoluble problems, and we don't see any way they're going to be solved. And by the way, the fact that we got a 1.5 million bonus last year was absolutely beside the point, nothing to do with this, and we're not even sorry.
But earlier on, you mentioned Susan Greenfield, and in a way, you know, for somebody, I remember being really impressed by her about 15, 20 years ago. I was down at the Riverside, and she was in conversation with lots of other scientists, neuroscientists in particular. But the language she used suddenly opened up a lot of doors.
Yeah.
It's this, and I kind of thought, well, this is beginning to make sense.
Well, she's a remarkable communicator,
as a spokesperson,
which is why the other scientists looked down on her.
Yeah, but she uses metaphor, which again is kind of what artists have been doing.
Yeah.
Since time immemorial, and that's something that still excites me. Is that if you get in metaphors, you're looking for symbols, you're looking for shorthand, you're looking for pictograms, wordgrams to try and convey meaning. Then that's it's a really healthy state to be in, I think.
According to quite a few theorists who talk about the scientific creative process. Metaphor has a huge part to play in that too. So what's interesting is all this stuff about rational, you know, super rational, you know, man stuff. actually, the creative process is never linear and entirely
it's
rational.
It's very scattergun.
It folds in those experiences that the scientific mind has had. I'm trying to remember the name of. Bruno Latour, that's right.
Latour. Latour.
He wrote a book called The Laboratory Life or something.
Right.
Showing you that the most important things that happen in a scientific laboratory happen in the coffee room.
Right.
And are metaphorical.
Backstage.
Yeah.
Yes.
And have nothing to do with the test tubes. And the decision making is informed by the rest of people's lives. Hey, that's a surprise.
Yeah. I mean, I collaborated with a scientist 5-6 years ago, Mark Lithgow, who was speaking earlier on, and he's somebody that I think, in a way, we didn't necessarily share a language when we first started this collaboration, and the collaboration was also with Eden, and I had a kind of workstation with him up at Great Ormond Street Hospital at the time, which is where he was working, and there was just this weird kind of crossover, you know, me beginning to try and decipher what he was talking about, and vice versa. Eden always there as an intermediary, using a very basic sign language that she has, you know, Makaton. Me having to translate for Eden, him having to translate for himself, and me having to translate, trying to, you know, point him in the direction, you know, things that were inspiring me at the time, whether it be filmmakers, art, and so on. And there's this great kind of conglomeration, this fusion of ideas, and we infected each other quite severely, you know, became a real kind of love story. And I think we both moved on through life after that that collaboration, you know, having changed drastically. And the thing, of course, which goes, you know, back to the root of all this, the reason that we were together is because of Eden.
Yeah.
You know, somebody that came into this world, and in any ways, you could look at it as being a really negative thing. And if you were a pessimist, you'd think, oh, for fuck's sake, what am I going to do now? And it didn't have that effect on us. And, it's that positivity that, for whatever reason, I still carry around with me. And if things are difficult, then go out and see the world, and it puts things into a perspective. It really does put things into perspective. And, stay indoors, don't do anything. It's the safest thing. Go online, watch the news, but go and interact with the world, and things do change quite drastically.
So what would you have to say about this whole notion that everything is so global that it's not really going to matter what we do here? Even, like, our creative process. I mean, you know, in Timbuktu, they don't know about your art or your...
But they might be listening to this.
You reckon?
Apparently, you could get it on an iPhone. Aren't we streaming this live, I think?
Damn, possibly? I made my crude joke about sperm. Oh, dear.
Right. did you kind of draw a picture of him?
No.
Right. Well, how did the joke go?
No, we're not going to repeat it. Okay. So the connections, actually. Are we being serious or are we not being serious?
I think I am.
All right.
Yes,
okay. Right.
Severely. But... No, globalisation, things are getting bigger, but at the same time they're getting smaller.
Yeah.
And I think that's my experience of it.
I think that is, if you're interested, what I think, you're getting to know me a little bit better, because the very first time that I thought about the problem of globalisation for my decisions in the world I live in, I mean, maybe I was just very slow on the uptake, was actually when Anthony Giddens did the Reith lectures, and he had a ridiculous thing. It must have been right at the beginning when Blair was a hero, and Blair made some intervention over a loudspeaker in the middle of one of his Reith lectures. I mean, he wasn't actually there, but he sort of said something about, and they were about globalisation.
And was it choreographed? He wasn't like Big Brother.
It was
just
like,
suddenly.
Are there any questions?
Right.
Oh, there's a question from Tony Blair.
Right.
So the question came down from on high. But the point about it. Thing about the lectures was it was in this mode of sort of, you know, languid pessimism, you know,
right.
About it, you know, Giddens is a sociologist, it's all beyond us, it's all too big. Partly government can't deal with it because, well, as it turned out, you know, finance can be done, you know, at the tap of a keyboard across national borders and oceans and time zones and so really it was almost as if what we were being told was that we were absolved of responsibility. I mean, responsibility
because it was all out of our control.
Out of our control.
Right.
And that actually strictly and logically cannot be the case. If you go back to your cottage, you could wreak anarchy in some way by somehow being uncontrolled and irresponsible completely. Or you could do the bit I can't do.
But
could you do that again?
I don't remember.
See
doing
you in
it.
An ambulance.
No, it was definitely Tourette's. You get a fucking ambulance. That bit.
Yeah.
I can do that.
No, you could do. You could settle for that, and you could disrupt everything, and it could all come crashing down around your ears.
Yeah, I mean,
just because it was all global.
Yeah, but then I remember, you know, growing up, 18, 19, and thinking about Nelson Mandela.
Yeah.
And, you know, there he's locked in a room somewhere. Fuck knows where he was, but. You know, what's he going to do? How's he going to change the world? And he has. He's changed it drastically.
Yeah.
And, you know, I remember him coming out and there's this kind of this sense of there is a hero still alive and he does exist. You know, he's not this enigma that, you know, died years ago. And there was great hope and great encouragement
from
that release.
Yeah, that, I mean, you know, maybe Nelson Mandela is a good catalyst for this discussion because in a sense he didn't have to do anything.
No, he did nothing at all.
Through what had happened,
and the
absolutely, because I remember when a guy I was up with at Cambridge. That's about for those of you who come from Deptford. From Deptford, I was going to say for those of you who come
right,
being up with means you were there together,
right?
He
girlfriend boyfriend.
No. He got sent down, which means he got sacked from university for writing. He's climbing up King's College Chapel and painting Free Mandela across. So that was, for us that was.
So that was going way back.
That wasn't quite the point. But that was, so that was.
Is that the band? did you have a band on earlier?
I didn't, I'm afraid.
Right.
I did actually consider we might sing.
Yeah, we could sing. Can you sing?
Yeah, I can actually.
Right,
yeah.
I can shout.
Yeah, no. Yeah. So let's leave that. People are leaving in droves at the thought of it.
The thing about the ambulance was just.
You think that did it?
Yeah, I just.
Now let's get back to Mandela.
Sorry.
Right?
Yeah,
let's get back to Mandela. For me, Mandela was a symbol of. Not just apartheid, but of the sort of impotence of the little people in a nation. And, you know, you're very, very romantic when you're a student, particularly if you're political,
and
very
a
political. And a Marxist.
And a Marxist.
Yes.
Yeah,
right. And so it was just so, that was just, and frankly, I had the faintest idea who Mandela was or what he looked like.
Right.
I just knew that he was this person who had been completely, who felt the simple desire for freedom
had been locked away
on Robben Island forever.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
So when he came out, and when the whole of South Africa changed as a result of that fact.
Yeah.
I mean, it was completely earth-shattering.
It was a revolution.
And yet it wasn't anything he did,
mm-hmm.
except he kept quite quiet for a bit.
Yeah.
So, I think.
Yeah, I mean, that
should give us all hope that...
Well, it gave me a lot of hope at the time. Yeah. I mean, quite often, it's kind of, there are smaller kind of incidences like that that continue to happen. And I think Serbia was another example.
Yeah, it was.
You know, where just when you think things can't get any worse, how could that ever kind of recover? And it does. And... Mm. And also the Pepys Estate in Deptford, which is where I spent a lot of my adult. It's changed, and they had a TV program about it, so that really excited me. Tightened up my trousers, and I thought, at last, Pepys Estate, Deptford is on the map. And
you know, they're looking for a new warden of Goldsmiths College. You could go back and rule the manor.
From the Pepys Estate in Deptford?
Yeah.
No, it's too late. I sold my council flat.
Okay.
Margaret Thatcher allowed me to buy it. That was the big problem.
Yeah, but there you are, you see. Yeah. I mean, that's,
exactly.
If
hypocrisy.
You don't mind my saying so, you know, we were all suckered in to this idea that we had a right, right? Now, okay, we had an entitlement, and actually now I'm going to say something serious, because Stephen Rowe started, and I felt it was a bit irresponsible of me not to say anything more about, he was obviously sort of quite worried about this job I do, which was before you came in, which is that I regulate assisted reproduction in the United Kingdom, and one of the things that is troubling about that job is that all the people who are in your care, all the patients, as infertile people prefer to be called patients, which is fine by me, and they do believe they have an entitlement to have a child, and I have to respect that because of what they've been through by the time I have any control over what they're doing, which is they'll be, you know, trying to get some form of treatment that needs the permission of the regulator before you can have it, or something of that kind. Now, it does worry me. It does worry me that we have strong senses of entitlement, each of us individually. I don't know whether that came out of Thatcherism, that we have sort of the right to do things. Mm. We have an absolute entitlement to do things.
To get what we want when we want.
To have what we want when we want, and if we have the money to pay for it, right?
Mm.
And I think we've got to let go of that. For one thing, if everybody, absolutely everybody, is entitled to reproduce, the planet will simply succumb under
The sheer volume of traffic is going to be
on the M6.
London, I was thinking about.
So
it's terrible.
So we are just going to have to stop and talk about it. And one of the things that's symbolic about the long conversation for me is just talking to people you haven't met before.
Right.
About, don't laugh at me.
No, I wasn't. I was laughing at him.
He was like, I just suddenly realised you were laughing at him, but we're not allowed to see him, right? Because he thinks you look posh sitting there.
I can't see who he is.
No, okay.
Oh, no, he's not part of the band.
where was I?
You talk about Deptford, Pepys Estate, and how I should run for Dean of Goldsmiths.
That's right.
Yes.
Anyway, I think we've got to have conversations like the long conversation.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
People have got to start talking to one another across the... And not just predictably in the little groups.
Going back, you know, with the internet, blah, 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 ubiquitous, and you can make contact with... You know, I'm in contact with my brother who lives the other side of the world, friends that now live down in Australia, another brother that's making a trip overland by motorbike from London to Beijing that has his own blog. And, you know, it feels to me, if he's not blogged anything in 3-4 days, then you begin to worry as to where he is. But it's a sense of it's getting bigger, but at the same time, the paradox is it's getting smaller,
yeah.
You know, and you can trace it. Inherently, innately, I kind of always felt that I know what my brothers might be doing and my sister if they're away from home, and that seems to be even stronger now, that feeling, that sense of the world getting smaller,
yes.
And at the same time being able to travel further.
Well, actually, that phrase, the world is getting smaller, in a way that does capture the fact that with the speed of this information revolution and communication revolution, which really is... Because I'm a historian by training. I introduce myself. I'm a historian.
Is that what you said earlier when I wasn't here?
No, I didn't. I forgot. Oh. Nobody told me I had to say who I was. Right? An historian, as we're supposed to say.
Right.
An historian.
An historian.
Yes. that it's the second information revolution. The printed book was the first.
Yeah,
was
yeah,
the first,
yeah.
And that created that transformed the world.
Pornography.
We've been there.
We did it. I picked up on the
yes,
pornography. I
thought you
like
might.
That.
Yes. Okay. No. Well, so, I just yeah. And so there was this revolution.
Is that a speech?
Sorry, you have 5 minutes.
Was that a gong?
It was a gong.
I thought suddenly I could hear the long player. I thought the family
is.
Upstairs.
It is
were
the family. It is.
Just turning the volume up a little
it
bit
is.
Too loud.
It is.
I thought that's John Bissett's hit that bloody
if
gong
careful,
too loud.
You're
again.
Going to use the whole bloody 5 minutes out in responding to the first bell.
Right. History, printed word.
Printed word.
Yes.
Change the world. Absolutely change the world.
Yeah.
So there's absolutely no doubt that IT is changing the world, that the web is changing the world. Mm. And every time that some old fogey says to me,
students
don't know anything now. You can get an A level for writing your name.
Yeah.
I'm sure they discussed it before I came in. The standard of maths A levels has dropped catastrophically. Really.
Yeah.
It's complete.
Can't
complete
use an iPhone.
Rubbish.
Can't use an iPhone.
No, complete bollocks. Yeah. Because when I used to go into comprehensive schools as a sixth former myself, and you go inside because we were good worksy sort of girls. And you were trying to read Tolstoy, you're trying to read Anna Karenina with a group of sixth formers. This was down just outside Colchester. And you'd say to them, okay, well, do you know where Russia is? No. Do you know how big Russia is? It's about the size of Wales, you know.
No.
They actually, and yet now, no child, well, even if they didn't know, it would take them 2 seconds on Google
to work it out
to tell you the answer.
Unless they're American.
All right, but anyway.
Yeah, they have no idea, really.
So
I mean, that's small to me, but they reckon that's big.
So the world has got smaller. I don't mean just geographically.
Yeah.
People just know stuff about the other side of the world.
Yeah.
And they also know that those human beings are exactly like them. So that ought to mean that we ought to be able to solve the problem. Don't you reckon?
I think the problems will be solved, and I think you're right to be positive. And I would love to have sat on your lap. Most of this conversation, because
but you couldn't because my lap is
glow.
Too small.
Emitting a warm glow.
But in fact, no, it's the sofa.
So, Lynn, what made you choose history, though? How come?
I was actually a mathematician. I wasn't good enough at mathematics. I didn't.
So you
I'm
are
not going to say that.
A Jacqueline of all trades, mistress of none. Is that what they say?
Exactly.
Jacqueline of all trades.
Like you said you were.
Indeed,
Jacqueline.
Yes.
All right. Well, then we're perfect.
We're very, very similar. Yeah.
We are very
similar.
Yeah.
And you also
except
just
your family came from Deptford and mine came
some
from
of them no they Swanley
yeah, okay right.
Pikeys most
yeah
sorry
I interrupted you
history no you were concerned that it was a little bit of the job you have for the government is it for the government
yes,
that you now
yeah.
work how
yeah.
what's it like working for the government
well I don't actually fortunately work for them I'm what is called an arm's length body.
Ah,
which
so you're freelance.
So I'm freelance.
Right.
That's right.
So Tony there goes, Lisa, back by 5:30. You can just ignore him.
I can.
Okay.
Yeah, I can. So, but it is working quite close to government.
Mm.
And the answer is, before the gong goes, it is extremely scary.
Right.
Because nobody there, and I do not, this is not a party political remark. It
right.
is just about these huge, impersonal systems, which are the civil service and beyond, they have no idea
which way is up.
Which way is up?
Right, that's worrying. That is a little
but
worrying.
Everybody is working on their little bit, which is probably
yes.
what has made me feel that we'd all better bloody well connect up our little bits. There you are.
Well, that's food for thought. That's got me worried a little bit. Yes. Are you going upstairs for more later?
Of course I am.
Because if you stand near me, I'm going to really. Play well.
Thrust.
Yeah, play well. I'm going to stroke with meaning.
Oh, this is getting...
And it's an incredibly haptic experience, and I do recommend if you get a chance to just fiddle with one. You'll get your own bowl when you leave, I think.
I know. Will
fiddle
you teach me how to use it?
You're working out, but it does take a little while.
Yeah.
And maybe when David comes on in a minute, we can talk about that, because there's a moment. It's like riding a bicycle.
So
when you get it. Yeah, we're going to have two of us. There's the fella.
And
when you get it's quite a remarkable... experience and feeling, and there's this kind of haptic
but it's about connection. You are talking
yeah.
about something that connects,
and then a bigger and individually though it kind of sounds a little bit not quite right.
No, but the
sound
we're
rehearsing
so
it was
beautiful.
Not quite right, and then we get together and you're just doing your little bit of stirring or your little bit of tapping, and there's this amazing cacophonous beauty that comes out.
It's completely beautiful.
Yeah.
And so the long conversation down here is about connecting people, and then upstairs it's about cacophony producing extraordinary harmony.
Yeah, and projecting that goes it on out and projecting
out and on out, into the
yeah.
future.
Deep art.
I think we've just wrapped up. Please hit that gong. We've just wrapped up.
Oh.